Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I assume you're the one in charge? You had your men put something in my father's head. Key to lock away your treasure? It's ripping him apart. How do I extract the key?
You wouldn't know what to do with it even if you had it.
Oh, I know exactly what I'm going to do with it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Westworld. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
Welcome to the show, everyone. What we do here on this podcast is we recap every episode. We dive in depth into what is going on. We speculate about crazy theories, but we don't spoil anything from future week's episodes, and that includes anything on the next time on preview that HBO shows. You can find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. You can also email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. You may or may not hear my voice sound slightly different today. That is because I've been violently ill the last 3 days, and I'm only now starting to recover. So if I cough or do anything that an extremely sick person might do, that's why that's the case. And sorry in advance, but you know what, Joanna? I'm here. My illness programming is dialed way down, but it's still kind of present in the background, but I'm ready to do some recapping with you. So
how's your cortical fluid?
It's extremely low. I've been like sweating it out all these last few days trying to heal. So, still ready to dive into some theories with you, some responses. So let's get into it, shall we? We usually like to begin every episode by talking about emails that people sent into us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. And Joanna, you want to kick us off with an email from a listener?
Yeah, we got an email from one of my personal heroes, actually.
Wow.
Send us an email. Yeah, Kelly Sue DeConnick, who's a great comic book writer. I don't know if you guys have read her stuff. She did a great run on Captain Marvel, sort of like considered the person who resurrected the character of Captain Marvel into like more prominent fandom. She did a series called Pretty Deadly, which is amazing, and also a really incredible series called Bitch Planet. Bitch Planet, Pretty Deadly combined is what Westworld is. So I am not at all surprised that she's a Westworld fan. She's also a huge Game of Thrones fan. And she wrote into us with a request for some help, to send out to our listeners. Basically, she did this amazing Game of Thrones costume party last year. And if you look on her Twitter, which is @KellySue, or on her Instagram, which I think is also @KellySue, you will see photos of this party where she's dressed as the Weirwood tree from Game of Thrones and just looks amazing. It's her Twitter icon. It looks scary and beautiful and tremendous. And so she's like, her same group of friends who do these really inventive costume parties are doing a Westworld party this year. And so she wanted some ideas on what to wear that's sort of like a little off the beaten path. You know, like dressing as the Weirwood tree is different from dressing as like Daenerys Targaryen. You know, it's like a little bit of a like funky idea. So like she wanted to come up with a like sort of funky idea for a Westworld party. Her great idea was to go as the player piano, which I kind of love. And I think she should go as like, I don't know, a kind of bloody shot up player piano. She can figure out how to make that work. She said, I've toyed with the idea of the player piano, and that's probably my favorite so far. But if anything else strikes you or your listeners, I'd love to hear it. If I use someone's idea, I'd be happy to send them a set of Pretty Deadly trades even. Do not feel compelled or even pressured to share this on air, she says, but we are sharing it because I love a costume party and I love the idea of helping Kelly Sue.
Yeah, so you said Kelly Sue, yeah. She helped write Captain Marvel. That name sounds kind of familiar. Like, is it just me or is there a major Marvel film coming out next year based on that comic book? I think that's right?
there is a major film starring Brie Larson that's based on the character of Captain Marvel. You know, like, there's some inspiration from what Kelly Sue wrote surely in there, but it's not a direct adaptation of her comic book. But yeah, you might have heard of it.
Yeah. Also, you know, without spoiling anything, a major factor, I should say, in the wild runaway hit Avengers Infinity War that happened this summer. So anyway, I think this is a prime opportunity to help out a very brilliant creative force in the world today, and that is messaging or at replying Kelly Sue on Twitter with your Westworld costume ideas, right?
Yes, and I just wanted to run down a few ideas. I crowdsourced to some of my friends and came up with a few ideas. One was maggot Ford. So Ford's decomposing body with some maggots. That sounds fun. One was James Delos on a stationary bike, but that seems like it would be hard to get around a party dressed as James Delos with a stationary bike. One I really like is to go as half William, half Man in Black. So like do old William, young William, and do like have a hat that's like one half black, one half white. What do you think of that idea,
Dave? I think it should be a costume that if you, you know, tilt your head down and then tilt it back up again, it becomes a different face. You know what I'm saying?
To
be inspired by the William Man in Black transition in Westworld. So
the reveal. Yes. I love it. You could go as one of the mind eggs of the chestnut. So that's sort of like a hard concept to pull off. But my favorite maybe is to go as the can of milk. That Teddy picks up on the street. That's not necessarily as fun as like a bloody weirwood tree, but it's kind of a fun idea to go as the iconic can of milk that Teddy picks up just trying to look chivalrous. So if you guys have better ideas, and I'm sure you do, think a little outside the box for at Kelly Sue, KellySue on Twitter, and let her know what you think.
All right, let's continue with some more emails. This one comes in from Trisha Chapman, who writes into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Quote, I usually hate the virgin/whore thing, but it's almost inescapable in this story. Maybe it's even on purpose. We have two quote-unquote bad robots. One is a virgin who's been raped every night for untold years who becomes a battle leader, maybe a la Joan of Arc. And the other is a seasoned madam who was a mother in a previous life. They take arcs that are definitely non-traditional in many respects. Dolores is certainly bloody and harsh, not the traditional virgin daughter. It's almost like they've inverted her. And Maeve is far from the traditional femme fatale. She's an uber mom, intensely empathetic, deeply caring, hard at times maybe, but she is deeply feeling, harshly empathetic. She's caring to the core, while Dolores is ostensibly uncaring to the core. We get a hard virgin and a soft whore, which at first annoys me so because I hate the reduction of women to nothing more than that. But at second look, I like it because they're both deeper than that. Dolores becomes a soldier and so does Maeve. They just go about it differently with their own spin and in their own ways. They invert their own tropes. Dolores becoming unexpectedly cold, Maeve becoming strangely soft. If anything, we started out empathizing with Dolores and being neutral to Maeve, but now I think most viewers would call Maeve the main hero, right? The tainted woman becomes the hero. I think she's the key to the whole thing. End quote. So, what do you think of these tropes and how they're deployed in the show, Joanna? Obviously, you've expressed your strong opinion on the Dolores versus Maeve, you know, how interesting those characters are, with Maeve taking it by a long shot. But curious what you thought of Trisha's email here.
Yeah, I love this idea of the Madonna whore, virgin whore sort of trope, which I hadn't really thought about those two characters in such binary terms, as sort of Trisha says, we should reject binary definitions of female roles. But I hadn't really thought of it that way. And I really like the way in which their characters contradict the classic virginal heroine or the classic whore. I mean, like Dolores is virginal, but also, you know, I mean, has had sex, but I don't know. When I was reading Trisha's email and I got to like hard virgin and soft whore, I was like, yeah, I want to read this email. I think it's really interesting, especially since we see such a nice repeat of their earlier confrontation in the season. We see that again sort of in this episode. And I just really like the way those two characters are yinning and yanging. And yeah, it's true that I've said that Maeve is my favorite by far, but I really did like a lot of Dolores in this episode. And I always prefer it when I find Dolores interesting. So, yeah.
Indeed. I want to read this email from Rachel, who writes into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Rachel links to this New York Times article And she says, reading this piece about the long racially charged history of children being torn from their mothers, I couldn't help thinking about Maeve's desperation to be with her daughter. I've been wondering why she would be so devoted to the idea of reuniting with her programmed robot daughter, but I think it's really about robots trying to achieve humanity. Only creatures who are considered less than human, like slaves or immigrants, you know, treated less than human by society, would be treated this way. Solomon Northrup, a free man living in New York, was kidnapped into slavery in 1841. In his memoir, 12 Years a Slave, he described a slave auction where a woman named Eliza and her little daughter, Emily, were sold to different buyers. Quote, never have I seen such an exhibition of intense, unmeasured, and unbounded grief, end quote, he wrote. Emily's parting words were forever seared on Eliza's mind. Don't leave me, Mama. Don't leave me. Another child of Eliza's was sold at an earlier auction, and the wound of knowing that she would not see her children again would never heal. Quote, in the cotton field, in the cabin, always and everywhere, end quote, Northrup observed. She was talking of them, often to them, as if they were actually present. That's the email from Rachel, and I think she's pointing to both the kind of parallel between what is happening with Maeve and her android daughter on the show, and also like our America's unfortunate history of treating human beings as less than, but also that there is an unfortunate parallel with some of the policies in the current U.S. administration as well.
And this sort of like the shock that we or like a Sizemore maybe would exhibit over like Maeve's connection to her daughter is maybe similar to the way in which perhaps terrible shitty white slave owner Americans would be like, oh, a slave woman's connection to her daughter, like how strange that they would have those kind of feelings. You know what I mean? It's sort of like
the show the show confronts us with ways in which you know, creatures who are human in many, many respects would be considered less than human, right? And like the ways in which we dehumanize people. And I think it does so in a fairly effective fashion overall. And we can talk about the specifics later today. So, yeah, those are some emails. Anything else you want to say in reaction to that, Joanna?
No, I just I really liked it. And I love when our listeners send us in like articles that are not even directly related to Westworld. It's always, it expands my view of the show. So thank you.
Very thought provoking. And we appreciate you emailing us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. There will be some more time for emails later on in this episode of the podcast. But let's dive into season 2, episode 7, shall we, Joanna Robinson? Les Écorches, I think is how it's pronounced in French.
I think it's Les Écorches. But,
oh, yeah, Écorches. Yeah, sorry. The accent aigu is on that last E.
But before we get into this episode, can I do like a very – we had a couple requests for like a very brief timeline sort of catch up.
Yeah. I mean, I think the show is – every like when I don't know about your experience of watching a show, Joanna, but when I'm watching a show – anytime there's like new characters on screen, I always say, okay, this is 2 weeks ago, right? Or, okay, this is present day, just to like say it out loud, because I usually watch with my wife, but also to kind of make sure that I'm right. You know what I mean?
Right.
To like, okay, it's 2 weeks ago. Is that right? Because if it's not, then she'll usually contradict me. So it is pretty confusing to follow. So yeah, take us through the timeline, Joanna.
Well, we'll just say that in this episode, thankfully, like almost everything is taking place in one continuous timeline, with the exception of there's like a basically a frame narrative, right? Yeah. You've got the opening scene and the closing scene take place in quote unquote present day,
yep.
Which is at least a day, if not a few days after Bernard washing up on the beach that opened the season.
Right.
Right. So most of the episode took place, and I think it's like a week, not 2 weeks ago, but like a week ago, like midway through that 2 week gap that we've been talking about all season.
Yep.
But basically most of what happens in the Mesa and with Maeve and William and all of that is like, let's say a week ago. And then you've got the frame of Charlotte interrogating Bernard, opening and closing the episode, which takes place now. But all of the now is happening after Bernard washed up on the beach and after the valley was flooded. So we got an email, someone asking like, okay, if Charlotte and Strand, who's Gustav Skarsgård's tall, bald-headed Delos character, if they interrogate Bernard and they find out that he's a host, does that mean they knew he was a host when he washed up on the beach? The answer seems to be no, because the beach happened before that interrogation, which opens and closes this episode, right? So
yeah, and I do think like it is. I agree 100% with everything you're saying. Like that all makes sense, but I do think it is pretty confusing. Like. The problem is it all takes place in the same environment in this episode, right?
Not only that, but like similar characters. When you cut from like Charlotte in the past, Charlotte a week ago, Charlotte now, and she's wearing like the same
similar
thing.
Clothes, right?
Yeah. It's that it makes it pretty disorienting,
And when I say similar environment, I know they're in like Ford's like secret bunker, but like the color palette is roughly the same, and the environment like looks roughly the same. So it's tough to delineate between the two timelines. Usually shows basically there's like many tricks you can do to delineate timelines. I'm surprised the show didn't do them. For instance, the show could have like a very clearly different color palette depending on the time frame. I don't know that it really does that, or at least doesn't do that super effectively.
They could do a letterbox.
They could do the letterbox. They could do a different aspect ratio. But for an example, of like different color grading to represent the kind of different geographic areas, at least I would look to like Steven Soderbergh's Traffic, which I think did a pretty good job of delineating between three separate locations with three really distinct color palettes. So that that's one way the show could delineate. You pointed to Wardrobe is another way they could do it. And what else? Yeah, aspect ratio. There's many things the show could do to make it easier that it's not doing, and that's a little disappointing. But that's why you have this podcast, to help explain everything to you. So,
yeah, I mean the idea that Charlotte looks no different in the Mesa of a week ago and the Mesa now is maddening. Get her a hat. I don't care what it is. Get her something that like distinguishes.
Like maybe Dolores cut her hair before she killed her, and,
Or
before she wanted to kill her or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. So Elias Mata in the chat says, other than Wardrobe, it would be a bit too blunt. I mean, what's true is that Westworld has never fucked around with color palette when it comes to the present and the past. That's not something that they do. But yeah, I think just the simple trick of having Charlotte look at least a little different in the two different timelines would help us, because you've got that's
I was watching a video essay by this YouTuber named Patrick Willems, who's a YouTuber I'd highly recommend. And it was a video essay about car chases and how, he was comparing like a car chase from Quantum of Solace to like a car chase from Bourne Supremacy. And one thing that is really helpful is when, the cars are all different, right? So like they're driving cars that look really, really different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like you can easily tell just by a glance, you know exactly where everyone is located. Anyway, I think we've belabored this point for a sufficient amount of time.
The last thing I'll say is that a friend of mine, great Westworld writer Kim Renfro, has a timeline over on Insider. Also, a friend of mine, Dave Gonzalez, has a timeline over on Thrillist.com. I would recommend both of those timelines. They're really helpful. Kim's is super visual and sort of runs down all the important incidents that have happened on Westworld. It's really helpful in terms of orienting yourself. So it's titled An Essential Timeline of Every Important Event on Westworld by Kim Renfro on Insider. That would be something that I would recommend you have every Sunday to take a look at. So, a point that someone made to me on Twitter, I think today or yesterday, someone on Twitter was complaining about they didn't understand Westworld. And someone who listens to our show very kindly did what people often do, which is tag us in and say like, hey, listen to Decoding Westworld with Joanna and Dave. Like, it's essential for me understanding Westworld. And that's super kind. But the person who originally complained responded, yeah, but it's kind of fucked that HBO is making a show that you need like all this extraneous material in order to understand. And I'm like, yeah, I can't argue with that. Like, I'm so grateful you guys listen to our podcast, but like, it shouldn't be so disorienting, All right, we can move on. I did like this episode, so that's something.
and teeing it up like that, it was an awesome episode. No, I mean, all right. So the episode begins, as you pointed out, with a bookend segment with Strand, Charlotte. So it's present day Strand, Charlotte, Stubbs, Bernard. They all end up in the Ford's lair, where we saw in first season Ford commanded Bernard to murder, what's her name? Sydney Babson Knudsen, right?
Teresa,
right.
Yeah.
And it is revealed that there are many Bernards, like kind of stored away in there. And that's when all the humans realize that Bernard is in fact the host.
Right.
Pretty effective cold opening, I would say. What did you think of this opening scene?
I really liked it. I like returning to the underground lab. I like closing the loop, not to use a stupid Westworld term, but closing the loop on like Teresa's death, because I feel like that's a big thing that maybe Bernard never fully reckoned with. I will say, though, they used that. I know we don't talk about trailers and we don't talk about Next Time On, but that doesn't mean I don't watch them. And that image of all the Bernards hanging in the closet and Charlotte discovering it has been used in like all of the trailers for the season. Mm. And it's a pretty incredible shot that I do kind of wish had been kept back, you know?
Well, fortunately, I don't watch any of that stuff and I was shocked. but yeah, it is a really effective visual, and as with many things in Westworld, raises a lot of questions. Like, why do you need more than one Bernard? You know, why do you need like 50 Bernards? Isn't one Bernard sufficient? But maybe we can talk
If you could have 50 Jeffrey Wrights around you, wouldn't you want that too?
I gotta think about it, Jonah. I gotta think about it. So then,
I did talk to Jeffrey Wright for the other Westworld podcast that I do, about what it was like to walk into, like to play that scene. You know what I mean? Like, think about that, Dave Chen, like walking into a room and seeing a bunch of like Dave Chen bodies hanging from like meat hooks.
I mean, I barely can look in a mirror and see one Dave Chen, you know, so seeing many would be terrifying. Anyway. So then we flash back to 1 week ago, roughly, right?
Sure.
And we see Abernathy nailed to a chair, and Stubbs and Charlotte Hale are protecting him. And I mean, essentially, like Dolores is running riot on all the security people, and like completely destroys everyone. You know, and as we predicted, like, you know, they have no mercy against. You know, the aggro alpha male from last week that was really throwing his weight around, like, just we knew, like, would be completely annihilated this episode, and in fact he was. So, anyway, they're terrorizing everyone, and...
Coughlin.
Coughlin, that's right. Yeah.
Our Irish second Muldoon. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, like, there's more scenes of like them terrorizing the organization, and like, you know, some people might enjoy this stuff. I don't know. What do you think of it, Joanna? Like, at this point, every single time there's an action scene in the Mesa, my reaction is not like, wow, it's a really well choreographed action scene. The action is adequate. You know, it's completely fine. But my reaction is like, The security in this place is like the most useless ever. Like, that every single time there's an action scene in the Mesa, that's how I feel. But like, do you still get a thrill out of this stuff? What do you think?
I think there is a difference between the action that is at the front of this episode and then like the beautiful choreographed action that, like, where they use Beethoven at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And so one is artful violence that I actually found very intriguing to watch. And one was just sort of, aggressive. Someone pointed out, someone emailed this to us that, like, have Clementine's settings been changed? Because she has more shooting accuracy than, like, any single one of Lawrence's cousins or all of his cousins combined or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's some stuff that works for me, some stuff that doesn't. Teddy... I think it's important for us to see Teddy in sort of first person shooter a video game mode. I think that's important for us to see. But there's some other stuff like that. The Clementine thing, I don't care that much about. But I did like the Angela and the cradle scene. So it really depends, I guess, is the point. Like, just machine guns going doesn't really do it for me. We saw that like a bit last year with like Armistice and Hector going through the Mesa the end of last season. That gets a little boring for me, but there are some grace notes that really worked for me. So,
all right, why don't we talk about the scene where Teddy and Dolores get to the room where Abernathy is being held, and they kind of have this confrontation with Charlotte Hale, and Charlotte tries to like play it off as though she's their friend, like, oh my god, this, what a scientific breakthrough that you've started murdering everyone, you know. And then kind of talks her way out of things and is almost murdered by Dolores before escaping mysteriously. Like, what did you think of the Dolores Charlotte interaction?
I think we've talked a little bit about like how I don't necessarily love how they're using Tessa Thompson on the show this season, but I do like the sort of fake, she's like, oh, Dolores. And you're just like, okay, all right, Charlotte, you know, like that is like giving at least, Tessa Thompson a few other, notes to play.
Yeah.
In her character. And then a similar, I actually even liked even more Stubbs's greeting where he's like, Teddy, like, buddy, Teddy, you're a nice guy. I'm so happy to see. Oh, yeah. No, you are murdery now. This is not good. So, I don't know. I just thought it was the Teddy greeting cracked me up more than anything else. But generally the Charlotte stuff doesn't work super great for me. And also I don't really understand why Dolores was prevented from finishing the job. Like, we know she's not going to die because we know we've seen her further along in the timeline. Yeah. But like, Dolores is going for her head with the buzzsaw, and then she gets distracted by like bullets when
the whole thing is just so weirdly staged, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, Teddy not executing, like, Teddy's executing dudes left and right, and then the idea that he's going to barge into the room and not kill Stubbs, I can understand maybe keeping Charlotte Hale alive because maybe she holds the key somehow to like unlocking Abernathy, and like she wants to keep him alive, but like, why would they keep Stubbs alive? And then Teddy goes off on his mission, and then some other random dude takes his place. It just is all very weird, in my opinion, and not like particularly effective. So I thought it was kind of like an odd dynamic, and yeah, like Charlotte gets away. I mean, this is an episode, Joanna, that I think in general like brushes up against taking some really big chances, right? Like killing the Man in Black, killing Charlotte Hale, even though that wouldn't make any sense, because, or maybe it does make sense. Maybe future Charlotte Hale is a host, you know, killing, Maeve, you know what I mean? Like, it kind of comes up against these really big choices and doesn't take any of those paths. And that's disappointing to me. But, you know, I think it's most acute in this scene when Charlotte and Stubbs escape for no reason. So,
yeah, I mean, I would balance that with as much as some of that stuff doesn't work for me. Like, what does work for me is the Abernathy Dolores like death scene. And one thing that this episode potentially does, and I hope the show sticks to it, is change the stakes on death because the cradle is destroyed, which I know I'm getting ahead of things, but because the cradle is destroyed, that is a death scene for the character of Abernathy.
Yeah.
Who is a character we've seen since episode one, maybe not a main character, but like a major character. And like, that's a first kind of for these bots who we've seen like get blown up a million times, but you can always reboot them. You can't bring him back now that the cradle's gone. In theory, who knows? They could be hiding something else. I don't know. Never say never. But like, that's what it feels like to me, that that's the end for Abernathy. And I really liked the performance of both the actor Lewis Hertham and of Evan Rachel Wood. I want to give Evan Rachel Wood every credit I can, whenever I can, because people are mad at me that I don't like Dolores this season, but like, I really liked this whole father-daughter goodbye scene. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I will say, I'm pretty negative on this episode overall, but I agree with you that that was a really effective scene. So, really well acted, yeah.
Eamon or Amen, I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, in the chat says, I love guy action movie scenes that are slightly homoerotic, and the Hail Dolores scene made me briefly think of that. I agree with that. Like, because both those actresses are queer women, and it was like the beginning of Pride Month. So I put some dumb screen cap on Twitter where I was just like, happy Pride Month from Westworld. And it's like Dolores and Charlotte talking super close to each other in a very like Expendables sort of just make out kind of way. And so I do like, you know, you don't often get to see, you know, the badass female action hero and the menacing evil corporate person both be women, you know, like that's a different thing. But I agree with you that there's some clumsiness in the whole Mesa takeover. Yeah.
All right, Joanna, let us talk about the cradle and what's going on with Bernard in the cradle. And I just want to say, like, you know, every now and then, once every blue moon, which for those who don't know means on an incredibly rare occasion, I, David Chen, get something right. And I think I got something right about the cradle. Like, remember I talked last week about the cradle and how, like, there's something distinctive about code being fused into a host that results in the cognitive plateau thing. I'm pretty sure I mentioned that in the show last week. But that impulse seems to have been confirmed this week. Like that.
Wait, I'm sorry. Can you say that again? I don't disbelieve you. I just don't really understand what you're saying. Can you say it again?
So last week on the show, I mentioned this concept that like the reason hosts reach a cognitive plateau is that there's something about putting the code into like a host body, right? But that, like, code living not in a host body could theoretically be completely fine, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be confirmed this week mm-hmm. when Bernard goes into the cradle and speaks with Ford. And Ford basically just outright says that, like, the code in the cradle works differently than it does if it's implanted into hosts, right? And that's how, like, he's able to live in the cradle. Am I right about that? Yeah.
I think that's right. He says that if he had been out in the real world, he would decay and malfunction. But in the cradle, he can live forever. I don't know what that means for like what he then does next.
Right.
If his next action is something that would lead to a decay, I don't know the answer to that. But like, yeah, he seems to draw a distinction. I really like what he says. I think he says that the Delos Project is, what does he say, like a tune whistled by a soft-headed boy, like whistling a tune that someone else composed or something like that. Like a beautiful Hopkinsian delivery of that line. But just
nice
this idea
use of
that
Hopkinsian.
Like
Hopkinsian. Nice.
Thank you. But this idea that like the Delos Project is not functional, but he found a somewhat of a loophole. And like, I don't know if you remember this. I was thinking of you in this moment because like at the end of season one in the finale, which I think you and I rewatched just before season two, Bernard keeps doing this thing where he'll like accuse Ford of something.
Yes.
And then Ford will be like, nope, it's this. And he does it multiple times. And this happens in this episode. He's like, so you're going to live forever. And he's like, no, that's not what we're doing here. You know, and I was like, oh, it's the thing that Dave didn't like. And they're doing it in this episode.
I mean, that's I think it's just pretty rough as like a writing device. I remember once seeing a supercut of the phrase, you just don't get it, do you? Right? Like, there's a phrase that occurs in movies very often, and someone says, you just don't get it, do you? And when you hear the phrase, you just don't get it, do you, you know that what is going to happen immediately after that is an exposition dump of the actual truth of what is going on. And there's kind of a crutch that writers lean on that I'm just not a fan of, because it's like, okay, you let us down one path, and now you're saying like, oh, no, we're going on this completely different path. And that's fine to a point, but I think that Westworld does it way too often, multiple times, often within one episode, and I think this episode is definitely an egregious practitioner of that. So in this episode, Ford reveals what the true purpose of the park is. We finally get some answers, Joanna.
But it's like what we thought it was.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we got confirmation. Right? He says here, quote, every piece of information in the world has been copied, backed up, except the human mind, the last analog device in a digital world. We weren't here to, and then it said, we weren't here to code the hosts. We were here to decode the guests. And at that point, I said, hey, that's the name of the podcast.
Hey, that's the name of the show.
Yes. We're here to decode the guess.
I also, like, if it, whether or not that's a Decoding Westworld shout out, I don't know. let's pretend it is because we're egotistical.
100%. Like, I'm sure they were like, got to give Decoding Westworld a shout out there.
Let's just pretend. Why not? Let's just pretend.
Yeah, no.
But
I'm not pretending, Jonah. It's a fact. But okay, continue.
Okay, yeah. But just before that, there's like it feels like there's another shout out because Ford's talking to Bernard, and Bernard's like, what does it all mean? Where do we all go? And he's like, oh, isn't the story more fun if you find out the ending for yourself? Mm. And I was like, that also feels like a Decoding Westworld / Reddit shout out of like, calm down, detectives. Let's just all get there together, you know?
Indeed, indeed. So the idea is that okay, how would you explain what Ford is trying to communicate in this scene?
Of what the great plan is?
Yes.
Okay, so that the loops, so the idea of Westworld, obviously we know it's not just like a pleasure park for rich assholes, but it's also not just like a research facility to try to perfect AI, because that's not the point. The loops are not a way for like a Dolores to get smarter and smarter and better and better. Like according to the Delos plan, the loops act as a constant, a control in an experiment, and the guests are the variables. And when the guests go in, the way in which they interact with these established loops, these controls, helps Delos map their consciousness and their personality. So, you know, if you, Dave, go into the park and all you want to do is like paint horses in a meadow somewhere.
I would do. Yep.
That informs Delos about what your personality type is. And if I go into Westworld and all I want to do is, oh my God, I can't think of anything that makes me sound like a good person.
Go horse riding, horseback riding. Yeah.
Then that says something else about who I am. You know what I mean? But we're bumping up the same reset of Sweetwater every time. And so the way you react to it and the way I react to it informs them about our consciousness, because they are recording that because it's in the fine print, which we've known since season one, because HBO put it up on the website, what the fine print of the contract is, which is that they have access to our DNA and also, I guess, mapping our consciousness. So yeah,
what is to what end to is the mapping of consciousness? So like
so they, like, can duplicate them,
yeah,
so but, that they can make their own Dave Chen, which they can now if you've been
but why would anyone want another Dave Chen? You know what I mean? Like, I can the world can barely handle
Oh, buddy. I thought we already established that, like, I put five of you on a meat hook any day of the week.
Oh, that's so, that is so sweet. That's the nicest thing you said to me.
I'm pretty sweet, yeah.
But seriously, like, is that, do you find that explanation satisfying? Like, oh, we want to create.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know why they're doing that yet. We've speculated about this before. Like, say they want to take over the world.
Right, right. Like, that's interesting. The idea that they want to use it to... Yeah.
Or offer you a choice of a kind of immortality.
Right, right. Yeah. So I think we can say that there are, like, many possible reasons why they'd want to do it, right? But that, like, it's not 100% clear why yet? Is that...
Not yet.
Is that fair to say, right?
Yeah, I would say... I mean, like, something William said this season is he wants to answer a question... you know, that maybe humanity hadn't even thought about asking yet or something like that. And that might just be immortality. I don't know what exactly it is, but that's something, I guess is something that we haven't figured out yet. But, I think what's even more interesting is a lot of people had wondered sort of like, how does it work if you don't have, if the person hasn't visited the park, and that's how you get a Bernard out of an Arnold, which is an imperfect copy. You know,
right.
Ford did talk because, you know, as we found in this episode, the code version of Dolores in those scenes that we saw a couple times this season over the years ran tests in order to try to perfect this digital copy of Arnold into Bernard. We find out sort of what happens when you need to build a personality and you don't have that Delos mapping sort of technology at your beck and call. And that's like Dolores and Ford together sort of coded this version of Arnold into the Bernard character, and they did it inside the cradle and they did it over a long period of time. And these are this is the scene that we've been seeing this season, is of a digital version of Dolores running tests over and over again to try to perfect and hone this Arnold copy. I do know that Ford was like made Bernard out of Arnold, but took away some of like his willfulness. So it's not, it was never intended to be a perfect copy. I mean, the important thing to know about all of this is that Bernard is something different from Dolores and different from like a Jim Delos, right? He's not a host per se, in the same way that Dolores is. And he's not a human consciousness uploaded to a body, but he's some sort of weird hybrid, which is fun. So, yeah.
Right. And like basically there's something special about Bernard, which is why like, Dolores, you know, had to run trials on him, and why there's like multiple versions of him in that bunker. Right. Like there's something about him that's unique.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why you would, once again, I don't know why you would need so many bodies necessarily, but yeah, there's all of that. And we should say, like, because people will get mad at us if we don't, that last season when they went down into that bunker lab, there was something printing, a skeleton printing. A lot of people were theorizing that it was Ford on the printer or something like that. The printer's empty now. We see a robotic sort of skeleton of a dog, but that seems something else entirely that has to do with like the Greyhound and Jock and all of that. We do see Tessa Thompson's character Charlotte playing with an arm at one point, and that arm is not belonging to Bernard, in that it is a Caucasian hand on the arm. So I don't know if there is, I don't think it's Ford. But I don't also don't think if that printing the body down there was supposed to be a clue for something, I don't think we have a conclusive answer to it yet. So.
Got it.
Yeah.
So then, I mean, we should also say we had a we had a mind freak out last week because we were trying to understand what exactly those, like the opening scene from last week was, right? And so it was confirmed in this week's episode that that was in fact taking place inside the cradle, right?
Yeah.
And that Dolores was running, like, woke Dolores, who is in the cradle, even though we don't see her in Sweetwater, right? Or maybe it's woke Dolores in Sweetwater in the cradle, but like she at night she does the Bernard testing, right? Woke Dolores was just running a ton of trials on some code version of Bernard. Like that is the explanation of the opening scene of last week's episode, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And our lovely listener, Raymond Terry, made a bet with me last week that it wasn't happening in the cradle. And I made a dollar bet with him on Twitter and he gracefully lost. And I was going to let him go because he's been right a million times when I've been wrong. But he instead donated $10 to a charity of my choice.
Oh.
So I know. Our listeners are the best. Yeah, so happy Pride Month. The LGBTQ Center in San Francisco got a $10 donation. I think $11 donation from him. So
nice.
Yeah. Everyone's great.
Yeah. Your superior theorizing is making the world a better place, Joanna. okay. So let's see. And then like, you know, Ford reveals how Bernard was created and Dolores helped turn Arnold into Bernard in the house that Arnold created. We see the house again. And then Ford takes free will back from Bernard, right? Like, he like kind of puts his hand over the, you know, Bernard's head or whatever. And then like when Bernard gets out of the cradle and Elsie and Bernard get out of the cradle room, like Ford is, coexisting with Bernard. Like, do we even know what the hell is going on there?
I would call him like a passenger. It like reminds me of a lot of it's a classic TV trope that I love actually, which is a haunting sort of, or a crazy, you know, crazy person seeing some, I don't like that word crazy. You know, someone seeing someone who's not there or being haunted. My favorite version of that is this Canadian TV show Slings and Arrows, which is sort of a riff on Hamlet, but basically like he's being haunted. And something that Jeffrey Wright said to me is that they've been playing this whole time with this concept of reflection. And this is something that's like, I think, really fun and clever, is that we saw, you know, younger Ford this season in a couple different reflective scenes. And, you know, we thought it was just like a way to cheat around having to show like a CG Ford, which it sort of was. But at the same time, when we first see Ford in the cradle, he's reflected in the player piano, right? And then now that he's sort of this passenger on Bernard, the ghost in the machine, if you want to, often see him reflected in the glass surfaces of the mesa. And I think that's really cool. You also see him in solid form, but there's a lot of reflection, sort of fun imagery going on there. But yeah, it's confused. I'm happy that Ford's back. And a lot of people were like, you're going to hate this. He's back. Joanna's so mad he's back. I'm not mad, because I would have been mad if he had been like printing himself another body or was alive the whole time or any of that. That would have made me mad. This idea of Ford wanting to live forever as code is completely consistent with the speech that he gave last season when he died. And so I'm not mad about it. And I missed Anthony Hopkins a lot, as it turns out. And so all of the shit that he does in this episode, whether it's quoting William Blake, whether it's talking about the Library of Alexandria, whether, you know, like all this sort of classical hoity-toity, once again, Hopkinsian sort of stuff, I love it. I eat it up. I love it all. So I'm happy he's back. I agree with you, though, that I think this is something you said to me off air. It's still hard to get a read on the villainy of Ford, what's heroic and what's villainous. What he's doing to Bernard seems pretty villainous, but taking his free will, taking control of him, making him murder later in the episode. But something that we are reminded of that he said to Bernard at the end of season one is that in order for Bernard to wake up, fully wake up, which I think we can all agree he's not there yet, he will have to suffer more. And we saw Dolores go through a lot of suffering last year, and Maeve as well, in order to wake them up. And so this could be, if we want to give Ford credit, could be another version of just him tormenting Bernard more in order to fully wake him up. So that's sort of my read on it, of trying to suss whether Ford is like devil or angel in this particular scenario.
That makes sense. I mean, I think it is so opaque, the storytelling around Ford. You know, you spend most of the first season thinking that he's a villain and against Arnold's work, and then you find out at the end of the first season, no, he's actually on board all along. Big twist. And then, you know, this season he theoretically has set the host free, but now he's enslaving Bernard or making him, you know, enthralled to his will again. But maybe, oh, no, at the end, no, it was all necessary for Bernard to, you know, I just, at some point I'm just like, you know, there become too many misdirects for me to really be emotionally involved in the storytelling. And I feel like I'm, if not past that point, then like dangerously close to it at this point. I wish that the storytelling around Ford was a little bit clearer, personally.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what the storytelling is really clear about, Joanna Robinson? All the awesome people who kickstarted this podcast. Because those people are awesome. And we want to thank some of them today. You know, this podcast is only exists because of the kindness of a bunch of our fans and our listeners. And Joanna, I think you'll want to thank some of them, right?
I would love to thank some of them. Let me do that right this very second. I'm definitely ready. Okay, here we go. Allison Heim, Tom Burbine, Jordan Hayes, Kathy Reynolds, Alicia Watkin. Oh, no. This accent was requested. Okay. Mark Wolfgram.
Nice.
Yeah. Neil Joshi. Yossi Goffman.
My favorite is when like the listeners put a pronunciation guide that is like specifically designed to trip you up. You know what I mean? Like that is clearly meant to make you confused, in my opinion.
It hurt me a little bit. Okay, yeah. Stephen Taylor, Brian Parry, Sam Kessler, Shayna Levine, Mike Griffin, and John Doyle. Thank you guys so much.
I want to thank longtime supporters Danish Syed, Scott Hughes, Joe Davidson, Steve Sable, JT Wheeler, Jonathan Derkoop, Del Nakamura, Yusuf Al Nafjan, Patrick Spinoggle, Travis Thompson, and Dan Berkowitz. Thank you guys so much. You're awesome, and we're only doing this show because of you. So thank you for helping to make this season of Decoding Westworld possible.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Especially like all of you, definitely, but also I say this sometimes, just the names we hear year after year after year. Yes. It's really sweet. Thank you.
Yes. For many years you've supported us recording podcasts, so we really appreciate it. Okay. So just a couple more plot points to discuss. And, you know, we see Bernard kind of go back into the real world and start basically murdering dudes, right? We'll get to what happens with Bernard at the end of this episode, but just wanted to call out that like you were talking about him suffering more, and I guess part of that suffering is Bernard being forced to murder dudes.
We should also mention that a listener Zoe wrote in offering up, you know, like I think some people were when it was discovered that Bernard and Arnold were sort of the same person, a common portmanteau word that you'll see is Bernard-nold, I think, to mean both of them. But now the question is like, what happens to that portmanteau when you add Ford to it? Cause Ford is like a passenger now on Bernard-nold. So she came up with Berfordold. I've heard some other ideas. I'm just going to keep it at Ghost of the Machine right now. That's something that Jeffrey Wright suggested, but do you have any, Dave, you're good at these. You got a million of them. Do you have any ideas?
I don't know. Berfordold is pretty rough, I think. How about Arnoldard? Arnoldard. What do you think of that, Joanna?
What about Dolarn?
Oh, man. Inside joke, that one, guys. Okay. But if you have any suggestions for portmanteaus, email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Okay.
Annie in the chat says Fern Arnold. Do you get Fern Arnold? I don't know. Yeah, I want to make sure we don't lose the burn in there. Anyway. we'll think about it.
Yeah. Agreed. Don't lose that burn. Keep that burn alive.
Yeah. Feel the burn.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, anyway, moving on, the Maeve storyline. So last week, Maeve was running away from the Ghost Nation with her daughter. And she kind of...
Fuck that other woman who was there in her place, I guess.
Woman is freaking... She dead, you know what I mean? Like, she's gone. So Maeve, you know, like, takes shelter in this house and comes up against a man in black. And then it's kind of an echo of earlier flashbacks she's had where the man in black is terrorizing her, right? But this time, Maeve is able to use her psychic abilities to animate all these other hosts to try to cut him down. And she's, you know, using these people to, like, shoot the man in black, and he's actually taking what seems to be actual real damage for once.
Yeah.
But Lawrence, for some reason, like, she's unable to get Lawrence to do exactly what she wants. And she kind of urges him to remember all the terrible things that Man in Black has done. And Lawrence does remember. But before he's able to shoot William, or before he's able to finish the job, he's cut down by Delos at the last minute. What do you make of the fact that Maeve couldn't control Lawrence? My guess is that was a Ford, like, you know... bonus for Maeve was my interpretation of that. What do you think?
No, my interpretation is that Maeve can certainly control any host that is not awake. So, like your garden variety Shogun World occupant, apparently, or like all of Lawrence's primos, like all the cousins. But Lawrence is at least somewhat awake. We've seen evidence of that, like in him maybe remembering, like maybe Ford was acting through him at certain points, or maybe he did actually remember the man in black talking about his daughter in a previous sort of loop. But that Lawrence seemed at least a little bit awake. And if you're a little awake, you can't be controlled by Maeve. But Maeve does push him enough in his mind like she can't make him do whatever she wants, but she can still manipulate him somewhat. And right. she, and I don't mean manipulate in a necessarily bad way, but she does push him to fully wake up, yep. which he does just before he dies. Yep. So, yeah.
And then, you know, Della swoops in at the last second. We find out that Sizemore was able to call for help. Like, all he needed was that phone. He would have been fine, right, if he had that phone earlier. He was able to get, like, really feels like the Della's security is, like, inconsistent, depending on what the needs of the plot are. But regardless, he is able to get Della's with those, you know, cool buggies. And they mow down Lawrence. I think that's probably the last we'll see of Lawrence.
I think so. It's interesting, though, because like I'm trying to figure out, like, what does death mean at this point? And something that I've come up with is possibly it means head damage.
Yeah.
So like Abernathy definitely dead because they ripped his mind out and the cradle's gone. Angela we'll get to, but Angela feel like is done. Lawrence only took body shots, so it's possible Lawrence could come back. But it also felt like a good goodbye for him. Just like a really powerful sort of moment for him. I like Clifton Collins Jr. a lot, but it does seem like they have a lot of extraneous characters and it wouldn't hurt for them to start culling a little bit. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of like a Highlander situation, Joanna, where you must cut off the head in order to actually kill. So
wow, that's so a quickening. You have to do a quickening. Yeah, is that what you're saying?
I don't.
And then the queen starts to play.
I don't think that's the correct usage of quickening, but you know, I'll let it go. But
are you kidding me?
Is that really what that term refers to in Highlander 2?
Are you trying to Highlander explain me right now? I'm gonna Google this.
Yeah, excuse no, me. I thought quickening meant something else, but you know, it's been decades since I've seen that film, so you could be right about that.
Like when you kill them, when they cut the head off, the quickening happens because all the power emerges from their body. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. No, yeah, you're probably right about that. Man, okay. That was a terrible movie series.
No, how dare you? Highlander's a classic. Also the TV show starring Adrian Paul, also a classic.
Okay, yeah, no, definitely. I definitely will give you the TV series for sure.
Who wants to live forever, Dave Chen? That's an important question in Westworld and Highlander.
Yeah, I mean, they have so much in common, especially production values. But, okay, let's move on. Sizemore, like, kind of, you said here in the show notes, she kind of saves Maeve. I mean, basically, he keeps Maeve from being manhandled more, right? And is like, no, we got to save her. She's like not one of the terrible ones, although she kind of is.
He more means that she's like her code is different.
Right.
She can do different things, you know?
Like she's maybe there's something special about her worth saving, right?
Right.
And then the man in black, you say here, inexplicably survives and escapes. So, you know, why does the man in black not alert Delos that he's there? Why does he not ask for help? Presumably because he's still on his quest, right, to the Valley of the Beyond.
On his door shit, but yes, but also why is he not dead is a bigger question, I think. And I think all the people who like think that he is already a host, like that the character we're watching played by Ed Harris is already a host, and that's maybe who Fort was printing on his machine, that arm that Charlotte was handling, maybe that's a theory. I'm not saying it's correct, but that's a theory. And so when I was watching this, I was like, welp, the William is a host theory. People are going to really enjoy how many bullets he took without dying in this episode. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's like something out of a John Woo movie or something.
We should also note that Maeve's daughter got taken by Ghost Nation.
Yep. So. Yep. Also worth mentioning. Okay. Back at the Mesa, there's a scene where Angela destroys the cradle. All these dudes are... like kind of attacking, but then she's just standing there like looking at the cradle, and then this dude gets seduced by her and then she pulls the grenade. You love this scene. I thought it was pretty silly. Why do you love it?
God damn, you're pretty.
Not just pretty. Perfect. Just as you built me to be. Sexy. Threatening, accommodating, but not unchallenging. Sweet.
boring. Smart. Not intimidating.
You're in pretty bad shape, Pussy Cat.
Perhaps. I could still do what you built me to do.
You know, Reddit hates it too. It's interesting.
Thanks
don't
for comparing
know.
Me with Reddit, but yes.
You're not the same.
I'm basically the personification of Reddit, yes.
No, I don't know why I loved it so much. One of my friends pointed out to me that Angela definitely like does her hair between when she gets off the train and when she's in the Mesa in a way that like neither Clementine or Dolores did. She's got this like amazing, like beautiful Brigitte Bardot sort of hair, but like why do I love it? I like "Welcome to Westworld." That's her last line. I like that a lot. I don't
it is
know.
A good one-liner.
And it seems to be the end of Angela, and I kind of like that she went out like that. I kind of like that she weaponized, you know, her sex bodiness. Yeah, is it impractical that this like Delos Merc would be so duped by her when he's seen all these like robots killing people? Sure. But at the same time, if you go back and rewatch the episode, you'll see that character, like throughout the episode, is saying like really dumb aggro masculine things like, yeah, fuck these bots. I got, you know, like he's the personification of a shitty gamer.
Amazing,
that's who he is in the episode.
Amazing interpretation of that dude or impression of that dude, Joanna. Very nice.
Thank you. I've been working on it all week. But yeah, he's like, you know, he's like his fragging people. That's what he's doing. Like if you like he doesn't seem he's not a character we know a lot about. But at least in this episode alone, they establish him as like a stupid ass dude who thinks with his crotch. And so like that at least is consistent. Do I wholly buy that? Maybe not. But it's worth it for me for the payoff and the welcome to Westworld closer for Angela. I liked it.
Here's, you know, let me say this, Joanna. I thought the whole scene was extremely silly and not very plausible, but there is one positive to it, which is I think it serves as kind of a meta commentary about society's expectations on women, right? She goes into that whole speech about how, like, you know, I'm just as you built me to be, sexy but not threatening, accommodating but not challenging, sweet but not boring, et cetera, et cetera. And it's kind of about how society expects women to be like this impossible balance of
absolutely
all these different characteristics, and how like you know in the world of this the universe of this show that like we've extended those expectations like because these are robots. That somehow we are able to achieve this kind of imposition of these expectations in a way that already takes place in the real world, and you know, obviously has a lot of problematic associations with it right now. So I do appreciate the meta commentary. Like anytime, like Westworld, you know, they're talking about the robots, but they're really talking about us, Joanna. Anytime it does that, you know, I can ride it. Yeah, whoa, what's going on? But yeah, I mean, in terms of the reality of the scene, it felt pretty dumb. And like, what was her plan? What if the dude didn't have grenades, you know? Anyway. Okay, so they blow up the cradle.
I liked it. Yeah.
Hey, I just praised it for making a pretty profound point. But yeah, anyway. So they get to the Mesa just as Sizemore and Maeve get to the Mesa just as the Delos people are fleeing. Maeve is dying on the gurney. And then we have Beethoven Symphony Number 7 as Hopkins talks about the Great Library burning and what the stories became. And we watch the hosts slaughter the Delos employees in slow motion. I think this is a direct reference to the opening scene of The Fall, directed by Tarsem. Which is also plays Beethoven's Symphony Number 7 and takes place in extremely slow motion. And there's like this act of violence that happens during it. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like I'm being derogatory, but I actually think it's awesome.
Beethoven 7th is my favorite Beethoven. I became obsessed with it when the trailer for The Fall came out.
Yeah.
Cause it also plays over the trailer, which, just has like so many beautiful, shots in it, and I watched it a million times before The Fall came out. And then, yeah, you're right, the opening, it plays over the opening, which is sort of like a stunt accident on a film.
Yeah. And we should say The Fall, by the way, is like a movie, like, I don't know that it's a great film, but there is nothing else like it, and it's worth watching.
I think it's the most beautiful film ever made.
Yes. Definitely up there.
Does it have the most amazing performances ever? Maybe not. Is that the most coherent plot ever? Maybe not. But I think it's the most jaw-droppingly beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And the use of Beethoven's Seventh immediately recalled that to me. I put that on Twitter yesterday, and a bunch of people were like, what about the Nick Cage film Knowing or No Wanting or whatever it's called? And I'm like, cool, I have not seen that. I would recommend The Fall over this Nick Cage movie.
I have seen Knowing, and The Fall is a better film. So just gonna
or you could just listen to Beethoven, I guess, if you wanted to. Yeah. But see The Fall, or at least watch the trailer. Anyway, yes. Great use of Beethoven.
Yeah, great scene. Really well done. And then Maeve and Dolores meet up. Dolores offers Maeve a mercy death, but Maeve doesn't want it. There's this kind of like profound moment when like Dolores realizes what Maeve is doing. She's looking for her robot daughter, and Dolores says, "The kin they gave us is just another rope they use to lash us down." And there's a lot of like kind of slavery terminology invoked in this episode. The idea that like the cradle is a prison for the hosts, like it's because they can use the cradle to reanimate the hosts. It's how they keep them enslaved, right? It's like a way of oppressing them.
Our chains,
right?
Yeah.
And so are like the positive memories. You write here, Dolores's guilt over what she did to Teddy seems to be leading her to spare Maeve. Tell me more about that. Like, I don't know that that's part of the text, but I think that's like. It's definitely a very reasonable conclusion. Tell me more.
I'm just trying to figure out, like, when Dolores takes out her gun, she's like, they're going to use the code in your head to, like, try to stop us and stuff like that. And so I was like, oh, shit, does Maeve die, right? Like,
yeah.
I could see, like, well, I also thought Maeve might die. Like, that's the thing is, like, this episode, I kind of felt like, I was like, well, they could kill William here. And I actually, like, the Man in Black, they could kill him here. And, like, it would be crazy, but they could. They could kill Maeve out there in the field, I thought, for a second. It would be crazy, but they could. Or Dolores could kill Maeve on this gurney right here. And that's what I mean about sort of the stakes feeling like they've changed a bit. And so when she got out her gun and she's like, you've got code in your head, they're going to use it. I was like, well, shit, like Dolores is a badass bitch. This season is not going to let anything possibly get in her way. And if Maeve is a liability, if leaving Maeve there dying is a liability for her, then she's going to get rid of Maeve. So why does she spare Maeve when she hasn't spared anyone this season? And I think it's because whatever she did to Teddy has made her question her like unrelenting sort of determination and cruelty. And she's sort of like, okay, there, you know, and Maeve even says like, explain why you did that to him? Like Maeve clocks Teddy in his like hot black flak jacket and is like, that ain't the Teddy I know, you know? And so she's like, is that why you did that to him? You know what I mean? And I think Dolores gets like a twinge about that. And so that's my best interpretation of why she would spare Maeve here. It feels like a character progression for her, which I love to see in Dolores. Great, great, great. But you're right. It's not. It's more subtext than text, but that's my interpretation.
I think so. It's completely a reasonable view of that scene. So, yeah. It seems like it makes sense. I think this leads us to a question that Thomas from Millwood, New York, writes into us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com, Thomas kind of gives you a hard time in this email, Joanna. He writes, I have to say your harshness towards the character Dolores was really bugging the shit out of me for a couple of reasons. Number one, precisely how would you expect a newly sentient being to react when it discovers it has been raped and murdered for the enjoyment of its creators for years? And number two, which to be fair, you acknowledge. Number two, how do you know where the story is going? Perhaps it is going in a direction that will at least partially, if not completely, justify her actions. Maybe you do. I don't know. But come on, let's keep an open mind. End quote. And, Thomas goes on to kind of identify that, like, if anyone is more guilty of doing monstrous things. It's Maeve. Like, theoretically, Maeve has more blood on her hands. Maeve talks about freedom, but where was the freedom for all the Shogun World hosts that she made turn against each other? Do you know? Or all the other people that she makes march to their death? Like, are their robot lives less worthy because they're not woke or whatever? You know, like, I do find it to be really muddy in terms of why, like the themes that the show's trying to get across, but like Maeve is controlling people and seems like, and the way the show plays it seems to be that we aren't supposed to think about like all the people that Maeve makes march to her death. We are supposed to think about Teddy because like Dolores has those really concerned look on her face. But like, is anyone like batting an eye about all the dead hosts that Maeve has controlled? Anyway, what do you think of this, Joanna?
No, I do. I think that's a really reasonable point. It's hard with the Shogun World hosts because like these were guys who are going to like attack her. They're working in support of the Shogun who was, you know, exploiting Akane and all this sort of stuff like that. So they're sort of like they're bad robots in that, like, not because they're awake or not, but because they are like doing bad guy things. And if you have like an analog in Westworld and it's like a, you know, some guy who like rapes people over and over again, and you're sort of like, and Maeve kills that guy or turns those bandits on each other or something like that, then like you're not that sad about it. But it gets more complicated when you have people like Lawrence's Primos, like who she used as cannon fodder in this week's episode. Like, you know, those guys, when the Man in Black killed them in Las Amuras, we're supposed to feel bad for them. So when Maeve uses them as cannon fodder, then, you know, are we supposed to feel bad for them? I think that's a good question that I don't know that the show is entirely interrogating, and it should. So, yeah, I agree.
But maybe it will, Joanna. Maybe it will. I really doubt it. I'm just going to put it out there that I don't think it will. But just because of the language of the show until this point, you know what I mean? Like, there's no like moment with Maeve agonizing over all the dead hosts that she's, you know, caused. There's not even
there's people like Craddock and his men, you know, and when Craddock and his men die, you're just not that sad about it because like with their small degree of wokeness, they just, you know, enacted more violence.
Yeah.
And so you're sort of like, okay, those are quote unquote bad guys. Yeah. But is Hector a bad guy? He's also a bandit. So like I don't know. I think it's not a thing that the show has been super clean about. I would agree.
Final sequence. Well, is there anything else you want to say about anything other than the very last scene of this episode? I do think it was kind, like visually it was very cool, like this, you know, very theatrical, like very obvious, the scene when like Bernard picks up the machine gun and shoots a dude and he's illuminated by the machine gun, like, you know, the lights in the thing go off at that exact second. It's a beautiful shot, but it's like, okay, like like the lights go off at that exact second for him to be illuminated by this gunfire, and then you see Ford holding the gun. That's a cool effect, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. I think there's a lot of beauty in this episode. There's the framing of Dolores and Maeve, like Dolores is backlit as she's standing over Maeve.
Great shot.
It's great shot. Super beautiful. Yeah. And all the slow-mo Beethoven violence is beautiful as well. So yeah, there's a lot of really cool stuff going on. A little messy, but like, but most importantly, I just feel like there's a lot more clarity. I was so worried about the cradle last week and the fact that the cradle's destroyed now. I'm like, oh, cool. Like, I don't have to worry about the cradle being like at least an ongoing, like anything could be happening at any given time in the cradle sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for that. And all of our timelines, you know, it was almost everyone was on the same timeline. And then they even got Maeve on the same timeline because they brought her into the Mesa. So, you know, Maeve's on the same time. So like everyone's on the same timeline. And that just feels like more clarity. So yeah. I just appreciated all the clarity that this episode offered. The frustrations I was feeling last week, I feel so much less frustrated this week. And I'm happy about that. So.
All right. So final scene, they are quote unquote waterboarding Bernard, or at least making him experience the sensation of waterboarding. They're basically
that was crazy. And that was, I thought, really good acting from, sorry to interrupt you, but I thought that was really good acting from Jeffrey Wright. Like the hold your breath. Okay, take your breath. You know, like, does that? No, just me. Okay.
No. Yeah, that was good. All of Jeffrey Wright's acting is amazing to see. Like, what's amazing to me when I see Jeffrey Wright acting in the show is I see Jeffrey Wright talking in like celebrity interviews and stuff, and he is like a completely different person. You know what I mean? Like, it's like unrecognizable in terms of his personality.
Yeah. And the distinction between Bernard and Arnold too, I think, is really, it's so subtle, but it's like a warmth in Arnold that you don't have in Bernard that I really value that. So yeah.
Final sequence, they extract information from the Abernethy's control unit is in Sector 16, Zone 4. Did you have any like paranoid conspiracy theories going on at this time, Joanna? Like, I had a thought that like maybe Bernard said a different sector and zone to Charlotte, and that, you know, he says, you know, and then he says a different one when the people are in the room. Because like, why would they have that scene where he says it and then she's like, repeat what you just said, and then he says it again with apparently no difference? Like,
1000%, why did they do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I had the same thought where I'm like, but I can't think of a thing that makes sense to me, because she doesn't exactly like give him a cue of like, okay, now lie to that. You know what I mean? Like, right.
but then like, if there's no difference, why not just have all those dudes in the room? You know, when
I have
like,
no idea.
Like, literally every shot costs money. Why not abridge? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, anyway,
I do.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. But I also couldn't figure out a reason why he would be then lying to Strand in a way that like Charlotte seems to endorse, you know?
Yeah.
But we do now at least, like, we know some things.
Yeah. What do we know?
Because
Joanna?
Of this reveal. So Sector 16 Zone 4 is something that we have seen before this season. We saw it on Costa's tablet back in episode 1. When they're doing their little, like, Bernard washes up on the beach and they're doing their little tour of the park, and Costa's like, oh, I found all the hosts. They're all clustered this one place. And if you look at his tablet in that scene, it says Sector 16 Zone 4. And then they go there and it's the ocean with all the host bodies in it. So when Bernard says Abernathy's control unit is in Sector 16 Zone 4, and Strand says, okay, we got to go back to the Valley Beyond, then we know that that flooded place is the Valley Beyond that they've been talking about. That there's likely, I think what we learned from this episode is that there's likely like a server, like a backup for all the consciousnesses they've been storing under that water. And whether or not it's destroyed by the water or not, I couldn't tell you. One theory that I like, that I sort of came up, well, I mean, I'm not the only one who came up with it, but something we learned last week is that the cradle is cooled by water. This is something that Jonah Nolan like specifically pointed out in this like behind the scenes interview with HBO. Not cooled by air, cooled by water. He was like, 'cause I thought it looked cool. And so if you look at the server room that they were in, Elsie and Bernard were in, like, it's, there's got water running everywhere. And so I'm like, is this other place, is the Valley Beyond, whatever server there, is it so massive that like destroying it in some way would result in that much water? Because like, where did that water come from? You know, we did see earlier this season, we saw the Mailing character like talking to Strand saying they were draining the valley. So presumably when they go back there, you know, in the upcoming episodes, it will have been drained and we'll see what's at the bottom of it. The other thing I want to say, though, is like, because I feel like it's been a, would you agree with me that it's been sort of a mystery, like what is the Valley Beyond this season?
Yeah.
Like, where are they going?
Joanna, if you ask me the question, would you say it's a mystery blank this season? Then the answer is always going to be yes, pretty much.
So I was rewatching episode 1 after I watched this episode. And when they roll up to that body of water filled with all those bodies, so I think it's Strand. It's sort of 80 yards, so I couldn't tell you who says it. But some male voice says, the valley's just beyond that cliff right there. And then they go and they look at the water. And so, you know, they kind of told us where the Valley Beyond was, just beyond that cliff, in episode 1 of this season, I would say. But yeah, so, you know, we know where the Valley Beyond is. We know where everyone's going. We know that Dolores is going there. We know that Bernard and Elsie are going there in the like week ago timeline. Dolores is going there. Bernard and Elsie are going there. And we know that once they got there, something happened that it flooded. Right. And Teddy wound up in the water. One last thing I'll say is that Ghost Nation, or at least Maeve's homestead, is in Sector 15. So that's right next to Sector 16. Mm. So there's a reason for like Maeve and William and whatever to be close to the Valley Beyond as well, if they're in Sector 15 and they're going to Sector 16. So, yeah, that's my more paranoia, and forgive that like info dump, but my more paranoia of that last scene with Bernard is that he's lying to them mm-hmm. about where, not necessarily where Abernathy is, but like that in telling them Sector 16 Zone 4, he's leading Charlotte into a trap, because Dolores does threaten her in this episode. She says, "You'll die in that valley." I think it feels super likely that Charlotte dies in that valley before the season's over. So, yeah, that would be my guess.
All right. Yeah. Closing thoughts on the episode, Joanna?
Sorry. Let me just run really quickly. Marina Midori, who's both in our chat and sent us, I think, like 5 theory emails this week, who's great. I just want to run through like a few things that she said. She's had one idea of like why all the bodies found in the lake had been wiped clean. You know, because we heard a couple of weeks ago that you know, a bunch of the bodies, maybe including Teddy's, had been wiped clean, that there was nothing in their mind eggs, not to protect themselves from Delos, but they maybe that they had already transferred themselves over into human facsimiles, and maybe that's how they get that, like, maybe that's their door out of the park, is to put themselves in like human bodies, so that the C4 in their spine isn't an issue or something like that. Like maybe that's the door out, because like we learned in this episode that Abernathy's head is the key, and they mean like an encryption key, and it has to do with the Valley Beyond. Like his, what's in his head is an encryption key to the Valley Beyond. That's important. But like, we don't want to ignore the use of a key when we've been talking about a door all season. Right. So like the door and the Valley Beyond, you know, feel one and the same. So that's sort of an idea. And then the other is, from Marina, is to bolster up this sort of William as a host theory. She's like, you know, the, another person in addition to Arnold that Dolores and Ford know kind of well is William. And so it's possible that like Ford could have built, his, you know, captured the William consciousness, in the cradle. And that's something that could be going on. Anyway, a lot of things to think about. Let me ask you before we finish out, because I'm sure you're ready to be done. But like, do you think William, as played by Ed Harris, is a host?
That is a tough one. And oh yeah, you know, last week I think it was last week, right? I put forward the idea that because he couldn't remember his daughter and his wife, like he couldn't get those memories correct, that was an indication that they had messed up his backstory and he was a host. Some people brought up the idea that he's suffering from Alzheimer's, or he's dying in some way, and like that's right. Why he couldn't remember. I brought that idea up to you. You are still going with the bad dad theory, right? That scene was meant to demonstrate he's a bad dad, right?
Either that, or like, I think the other common theory is that he was sort of performing a test on his daughter. Maybe.
Right. Maybe it was like a reverse. I don't know. The language, like the way that scene is played, does not feel to me like he's the one testing her. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Typically the indignant person is the one who's doing the testing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I would put him at a 50% chance of being a host. That's a cop out, but I think there's a significant likelihood. So.
Okay. Did you want to talk about the Charlotte thing really quickly before we go?
The Charlotte thingy. Remind me what that is.
The Charlotte thingy. We had a couple emails about this, I guess.
Oh, yeah, like yeah. Some people think that like Charlotte is actually Bernard's daughter, right? Because we see a few scenes of like Bernard flashing back to Charlie. Charlotte kind of sounds like Charlie. You know, What do you think of it? Like, you don't like this theory, right?
When Dave brought this up to me, I was like, we debunked this last season. I wrote an article about it on VF.com last season where I was like, is Westworld hiding one final twist? And it was like a couple episodes from the end of season one.
That is how I read all your headlines, FYI.
Thanks. Yep. That's how I read them. Because Charlie sounds a lot like Charlotte, and because, you know, for other melanin reasons, based reasons, like, is Tessa Thompson's character related to Jeffrey Wright's character? I feel like we got that answer definitively as no last season. That, like, I was like, well, maybe, because I was like, well, maybe his memories of his son Charlie are actually of a daughter Charlotte. But, like, Charlie died, and Charlie is a guy. Charlie was a, I mean, not to get gender binary or whatever, but I was like, oh, maybe he'll like remember that it was actually Charlotte, not Charlie, but it's definitely Charlie, who at the time presented as a boy and definitely did die. I do not like this theory that Charlotte is his daughter at all. No. Why do you like this theory?
Well, I mean, you say he definitely did die. Like, what is the evidence that he definitely did die?
It's like the whole reason that Arnold like did everything.
Yeah. I guess
it's because his son died.
I guess that makes sense. All right. Well, there you go.
As Beatrice says in the chat, I thought we were over that last season. I agree, yeah. Beatrice, but it popped on Reddit for some reason this week. And because it did, we got a whole bunch of emails about it. So thanks, Reddit. No, I just don't like that theory. But everyone is a precious diamond who emails us. So thank you.
All right. Well, I think we can end it there. Yeah. Overall, it sounds like you were a fan of this episode, like righted the ship a little bit. I am like starting to get pretty frustrated with the show at this point, and I think that's pretty obvious. I don't need
do
to
you,
yeah.
Do you feel more or less frustrated than you did last week?
I feel equally frustrated, I would say. Okay. I feel frustrated. Like, you're right, the cradle resolution is good, but that other things are frustrating about this episode, like the whole Ford-Bernard dynamic. So... but we'll see. Still three more episodes remain. You can always email us, let us know what you think at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me at vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Like I said before, I did get to talk to Jeffrey Wright about this episode over on the podcast Still Watching, Westworld.
Find all of my stuff at DaveChen.net. I'm on YouTube at youtube.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, SKY, and on Twitter at Dave Chensky. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.